Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and hope our audience is enjoying a very happy and healthy Mother's Day after what has been a very tough year. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll stands at about 581,000 as nations worldwide mobilize to help India as the pandemic rages out of control there, taxing the nation's healthcare system. Egypt ordered more Rafale fighters from Dassault, as well as A330 refueling and cargo aircraft from Airbus, as Leonardo, Hensoldt, and many other companies posted earnings. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Everybody, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
It's always a pleasure, Vago. Thank you.
Happy weekend, Vago. Great to be here.
Great. Absolutely great to have you guys. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Ron, how did the group fare this week on broader markets?
Yeah, so when you look at A&D on the week, it was mixed. The S&P was up about 1.5%. The defense stocks broadly outperformed the S&P. I mean, the two big bellwethers there are Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin was up about 2.5%. Northrop Grumman was up about 4.5%. And on commercial aerospace, they underperformed the market. You know, Boeing was roughly flat on the week. A good bellwether for the aftermarket is TransDigm. They were down about 1% this week. So we've seen a couple of weeks here where defense has been outperforming commercial aerospace and outperforming the broader market, and that continued this week.
And what are some of the other factors, right? I mean, on Friday we had economic numbers that were not as strong as everybody expected, right? I mean, I think it was 500,000 unemployment claims. A little bit of concern about, you know, fiscal policy and whether or not the extension of unemployment benefits, for example, is keeping people at home, especially at the lower income range. That's affecting restaurants and other service industries that are having trouble. You know, whenever you see Denny's commercials running on TV, right, you understand that there might be a bigger challenge and problem there. What are some other sentiments that we're seeing on the street? Because I have to say that after our relatively bearish discussion of inflation, I did get quite a lot of mail from people saying, look, you know, that these concerns are overwrought and they've always existed. One of them was an economist, so I'm willing to give them a little bit more room on it. But give us your sense a little bit on what some of the other drivers and folks, certainly your clients, are talking to you about.
Yeah, inflation still is a big topic, right? So with specifically in aerospace and defense, it's come up on, you know, input costs. You know, one of the focus areas more recently, and we'll talk about, I guess, later in the podcast, is business aviation. And in business aviation, sometimes the contracting structure with customers is a little bit different than it is with Boeing and Airbus with the airlines. There's not always an inflationary clause. So, you know, what does that mean in terms of input costs and pricing on business jets, so on and so forth? But broadly, I've been getting more questions, and I imagine Sasha's too, from investors on what inflation means for our space. If you look at across the industrial space and just across the market, many, many companies that reported were talking about inflation. And I think it's still an open debate on, is it temporary? Is it not? In the middle of the week, we saw a little bit of a sell-off when Janet Yellen came out and said, well, maybe inflation's a little bit of an issue, to paraphrase. And then she kind of backed away from it. So we'll see. It's clearly a topic. It's a sensitivity in the market. So that's one thing. I find what's interesting, however, you know, the jobs number did come out on Friday, and the jobs number, the expectation was 1 million new jobs created, and it ended up being about 250,000. And you didn't see much of an impact on bond yields. So you might expect that, you know, the market would look at that and say, well, maybe, you know, that means that the Fed will be dovish for longer. And that's that, at least on Friday, that's not how it played out. So we'll see. But I would say still inflation is a concern among investors. And like you pointed out, I would say in the economics community, it's a debate. There's some economists on one side who say, hey, you know what? This is just a temporary thing. Don't need to worry about it. And then there's some economists on the other side who say, no, this might be more of an issue. And you know, I kind of fall out. Well, we'll see. And you know, it's ultimately hard to say, but we are seeing inflation now, and we have yet to see if it'll be a problem.
Because the point that was made to me right after the $1.9 trillion that was passed by by a Republican Congress, when the $1.9 trillion tax bill went through, the 10-year T-bill was yielding 3% and got up to 3.23%, and right now it's about half that yield rate. And, you know, folks are pointing out, you know, Yellen and Powell both have said that, yeah, I mean, we could get up to 2.5% inflation, but that's certainly manageable and livable. Sash, talk to us a little bit about some drivers on European markets, right? I mean, it was kind of an interesting week, a spat between really the Channel Islands, right? Jersey and France. And everybody should know that Jersey is independent, or at least autonomous. Independent, but the Royal Navy did send two patrol vessels there as French fishermen were blocking Saint-Helier. Just more broadly, what was performance on the week look like from your standpoint, especially on a week where a lot of key European names reported earnings like Thales, Leonardo?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very busy week for European companies and European earnings anyway. And then we had the War of Jersey 2021, which took everybody by surprise. I mean, at least now we can say where Ron we were is and what safe we were doing.
But Ron is safe there in Chatham, right?
Just kidding, for the moment. I mean, these things tend to balloon a little bit if we're not careful. I'll come back to that. Just to pick up on the point that Ron made about inflation and input costs. And, you know, I get the feeling in Europe that we are, well, I suppose in military terms, a tactical bound behind the states in the US in terms of worrying about inflation. But yeah, it's certainly an issue. What has been most interesting for European companies this week, or certainly European companies that we look at, has been the specific input cost problem of the semiconductor shortage. Many of our listeners will remember or will understand that there is a global shortage of certain semiconductors for particularly the automotive markets and related markets, which actually encompasses a lot of defense stuff, because this time a year ago, everybody thought there was going to be a massive global recession. And therefore, the semiconductor companies didn't bother to increase capacity very much and diverted everything that they had on forward or to mobile phones and tablets, because everybody was still going to be at home, shopping remotely and so forth. So there is a global shortage of automotive-related semiconductors, and it's really starting to hurt some companies. Interestingly, the company that talked about it most frankly was Thales, for their digital ID and security business, which is a slightly odd hybrid business they have anyway. But even Rheinmetall admitted that, you know, some of their products, and I wouldn't mind betting that this includes some of the smarter munitions they make, rely on semiconductors, as does a lot of their automotive products. And Q2 is going to be really interesting. So not only is there going to be a shortage of these things, but the price is going to go up. And that's going to create a bit of a squeeze there. Just on European markets and European aerospace and defense markets more broadly, it was a very, very mixed week. I mean, most of the European civil stocks were off a bit. Most of the European defense stocks actually were pretty good. Although the whole sector ended on Friday really well. I'm looking at the screen at the moment, you know, it blew across the board. There were a number of things. I mean, we had Thales report, and they had very, very strong orders, really excellent order intake, Bill. On a rolling basis, well above one. And you can see why Thales is going to be almost certainly raising guidance this year. Rheinmetall had already pre-announced, but that was a good set of numbers. Hensoldt, fantastic orders coming through. And then the thing that actually got a couple of the mid-caps going at the end of this week was Meggitt, where there was a rumor that they might be bid for by Woodward in the US. And that just highlighted the value in some of the larger European civil aerospace mid-cap stock. So it was a good week for the Europeans. And the final point, just about the War of Jersey 2021. This is one of those just bizarre things that happens occasionally. Jersey's a remarkably independent nation, protectorate, whatever you want to call it, most of the time. They decided to change the nature of certification for French fishermen to fish there, and the French fishermen, who are a pretty bolshy lot at the best of times, went absolutely bat. And there were some astonishingly ill-advised, generally anonymous comments from senior officials on all sides. Actually, when you look at it, the Royal Navy sent a couple of gunboats, the French sent a couple of gunboats, and the gunboats just stood off and behaved impeccably, as you would expect, and left the fishermen to do what they do, which they did for 12 hours or so. But it was terribly dramatic while it was happening. I really wouldn't inflate it much more than that.
Right. And I should point out, right, very ill-conceived for somebody on the French side to have said that we're going to cut power off to the islands. And I believe it's a bailiwick, right? It's the bailiwick of Jersey, if I understand.
Yeah, and that takes us back about 600 years. You know, yeah. It's you know, exactly. this is not a modern political construct.
No. And it's certainly a lot more interesting than the stone that was moved on the Belgian and French border. Hopefully we don't get into that. Richard, give us a commercial aviation update. I mean, you know, I've now traveled twice, went down to Fort Worth and visited Bell, and last week was in Charlotte, North Carolina, where was there for the unveiling of the new General Motors Infantry Squad vehicle. Had an opportunity to drive the vehicle. It was a lot of fun. Things moved very smoothly, and the airports vacillate from being utterly jam-packed and looking totally normal or looking actually eerily abandoned. So I'm, you know, struggling with sort of the duality there. And also, if you want to talk about Airbus deliveries, please feel free to do that as well.
Yeah, you know, this is my return to flight this week. I'm happy to say two different travels coming up. And, you know, what's sort of interesting is, again, we've been waiting for signs about opening borders before we get enthusiastic about a recovery in international travel. And, well, the EU is starting to talk about it, you know, possibly even sometime in June, opening up borders to U.S.
By late
tourists.
June, right? I think the EU has said by late June it would like to open it to American tourists. So I hope that your family vacation plans are not in jeopardy.
Yes, well, hanging in the balance. Thank you. I guess we'll see. You know, everything, of course, has to wait on that before we can get the RPKs, before we get the orders. Although it was very interesting this week, I saw a Lufthansa order for a handful of 787s and A350s. I, you know, really don't think there's going to be an availability issue for these twin aisles. I think it's a fair bit, but you are seeing these sorts of signs of hope, signs of life, again, waiting for the borders to open. There was, you know, Airbus, their, you know, first quarter, or the January to April, first third numbers, they were up, you know, about a quarter from 2020, same period. And, you know, that was certainly welcome news. Obviously, that was a response to U.S. and China domestic markets opening. But of course, you know, then again, India is a key market, domestic market for them, and there's not a lot of hope there right now. So, you know, we're starting to see exactly the kind of things that we should be seeing, given where we are in the recovery from the pandemic.
Ron, your sense on where we are recovery-wise, and then Sash, want to get your take as well.
Yeah, I mean, we seem to be muddling along, right? I mean, it's mixed.
And you traveled as well, right? You went to North Carolina.
Yep, I did. Yeah, it was my first flight in over a year. And it was, you know, just anecdotally, Newark Airport was empty, but my flights were full. So, yeah. But it was fine. You know, we're muddling along. I mean, the U.S. seems to be doing fine, better than fine, right? I mean, the U.S. thought we'd be in really great shape for the whole world was like the U.S. is right now in terms of travel. China seems to be doing, you know, fine. International markets are not great, like we talked about. You know, we're still expecting a, you know, call it mid-2023 back to 2019 levels. You know, there's still a debate, I think, in the investment community, and maybe even more so in the community, outside of the investment community, but more in the community that really focuses and tries to forecast air travel on, you know, how business travel is going to come back, what it's going to look like, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, we're you know, bumping along, you know, but you know, I think for most of the folks on this, you know, listening to the podcast, you know, the U.S. domestic market seems to be doing okay. I mean, I would imagine, you know, everybody who's listening to this knows somebody, if they're not doing it themselves or planning some sort of vacation or doing something domestically that involves a plane flight in the next couple of months. So things definitely seem to be traveling in the right direction. I believe if you look at the TSA numbers, you know, we've, you know, held over what, 1.5 million travelers going through the TSA now. For a while, and just to remind everybody, I mean, at the low point, that got down to 200,000 or below 200,000. So, you know, we're getting back to levels domestically where, you know, it's in, you know, approach, you know, on a trajectory to normal.
Sash,
I feel very, very left out here. I have not even booked a flight, and I love flying, and I, you know, love going to visit companies and clients and everything else. Haven't even booked flights, and I don't know anybody who's booked a flight from the UK for a holiday yet. So it comes back to the point that we were making last week, which is that for international travel, you have to have a vaccine at both ends. If you haven't got a vaccine at both ends, doesn't matter how well vaccinated you are. I had my second vaccination this week, and you know, vaccination program still going very well in the UK. But the UK announced what's called the green list, which is the list of countries that UK inhabitants can go to and come back without quarantine. 12 countries on the green list. And yeah, when it comes down to it, it's a joke. It really is. So at the top of the green list is Portugal. Well, that's fine. You know, nice place to go to. Great wines, you know, nice beaches. That's good. Number two, Israel. Fine, but more constrained in terms of capacity. The next three countries on the green list, Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand, are actually closed to UK visitors. So we're vaccinated. We feel that you are safe to go there, but they don't feel we're safe for you to go there at all. So I can't quite see the point of putting them on. Then Brunei, please. Iceland, please. Gibraltar, the Falkland Islands, the Faroes, South Georgia and the Sandwich Islands, St. Helena, Tristan da Cunha and Ascension Islands. So it's great if you're after Napoleon nostalgia. And indeed,
on the 200th anniversary of his passing, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they're half the countries on the green list have no tourism whatsoever. And that shows you that everywhere else is just a bit hard at the moment. It's going to be reviewed every 3 weeks. More countries will be added eventually. But, you know, the places that UK travellers go are the Mediterranean in the summer. So it's Turkey, Greece, Italy, Spain, France. None of those are on the list yet. And I think from a European point of view, you know, summer is looking really dodgy at the moment.
Ron, earnings, any U.S. earnings before we go to what was, I think, a very, very robust earnings release over in Europe. Sash gave us a little bit of a flavor of it, but I want to check with you about whether or not there was anything particularly interesting that anybody on this side of the Atlantic reported.
Yeah, so this week we had a handful of companies report. Last week was really a much more a dense earnings week. You know, from this point forward, we have companies reporting, but it's fewer with each week as it goes on. So we're kind of in the tail of earnings for us. But that being said, Bombardier reported this past week, and their numbers were, you know,
as good as you'd expect from Bombardier.
Well, better than that. I mean, it was a decent quarter. You know, it was their first quarter reporting as an independent business jet company. You know, they're getting some aircraft out the door and that sort of thing. So, it was fine, I guess. You know what I mean? I did ask a question around, you know, what's life going to be like as an independent business jet company, you know, a publicly traded business jet company, the only one, and how you're going to deal with downturns. And, you know, their answer to that question was, as you might imagine, it was, you know, kind of boilerplate kind of stuff. Air Lease reported this week, which, you know, is a bellwether in the leasing community. Their stock didn't perform well after they reported, but their numbers actually were pretty good. It was a reasonable quarter. It's interesting, at least in the U.S. markets, it seems like the reopening trade and that sort of thing is kind of getting long in the tooth. And I think that's what you've seen happen with, you know, defense doing better, commercial aero maybe not doing, you know, quite as well as it did before meaning late last year, or early this year. It's that, you know, it's kind of like reopening is almost here, right? And it's kind of one of those potentially sell on the news kind of thing. So it's kind of like, what's next? What, you know, where are we going from here? But, you know, outside of that, it was a relatively uneventful week.
Sash, some of the more granular details, right? Leonardo, well, Hensel, Leonardo, Rheinmetall, right? Some very positive news. Obviously, the limited, the company that, the joint company with BAE Systems got the Challenger 3 contract. And of course, Thales, you know, you talked a little bit about their being open about chips, but what were some granular details we saw from each of these companies?
You know, at the very broadest level, there were not that many surprises this week. Defense is going really well for European defense companies. The European defense markets are going phenomenally strongly. And Thales, Hensoldt, Rheinmetall all beat on expectations in terms of incoming orders, in terms of revenue growth, in terms of margins, where they reported them on those, you know, in terms of their European defense exposure. Leonardo is always a bit of a special case. They, you know, their defense businesses are very, very good. But the challenge for Leonardo has always been to tried to take cost out of their civil aerospace related businesses, where they probably face much greater government pressure because a lot of their civil aerospace manufacturing is down in the south of Italy and therefore is very, very politically sensitive. We were actually rather encouraged that management gets that. Management gets now that civil aerospace downturn, and particularly the programs they're on, which tend to be more weighted towards wide bodies, is going to be you know, down for longer. And hence they've got to start taking cost out. And that's very positive for Leonardo longer term. Problem, I suspect, is that having taken or being in the process of taking this very, very large stake in Hensoldt, and that's a stake which in cash flow terms and earnings terms is pretty dilutive, it's causing a lot of shareholders to scratch their heads. And you know, we think it's going to take some time for the momentum to get back into Leonardo at the moment. Just back to Ryan.
And I should just point out, and I want to point out to the audience, right, that's a 25.1% stake that they've committed to acquiring in Hensoldt.
That's right. And in fact, you know, just to follow on from that, you know, the interesting thing talking to the Hensoldt management was they are now talking quite a big talk about how this is going to be a springboard for European defense consolidation. I struggle to see that because unless basically France, Germany, and the UK, with Sweden, you know, coming up pretty close fourth, can agree to some significant mergers of capabilities for the Tempest and SCAF future fighter programs. Doesn't matter what the companies do, those two programs and all the capabilities that go into them are going to have to be ring-fenced. And I think Hensoldt is sort of getting a little bit ahead of itself in that. And, you know, possibly Leonardo as well. Leonardo, remember, has an Italian defense electronics business, a UK defense electronics business. And when things get a bit tough, those two businesses become very ring-fenced because the UK government is determined to maintain the independence of the UK defense electronics business come what may. So I think they've got to be careful not to push the French, the Germans, the Brits in particular, into different corners in terms of the two big fighter programs.
I want to talk about fighter programs in a second. Obviously, the big Egypt order is very important. But first, I want to get to the Falcon 10X. Everybody was very, very eager. We got comments from all of you about what it is we thought we were going to see from the French giant. Richard, what did we see from the French giant, and why did you think it was so interesting? Sash, you thought it was interesting. Ron, you thought it was interesting too. It looks an awful lot more like a Gulfstream than anything else the company's ever made.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is sort of the historical experience leading to this point. Basically, about 25, 30 years ago, they decided that maybe the top end of the market wasn't the place to be. It wasn't worth the investment, saturated and perhaps capped out. You know, the Bombardier Global Express and the Gulfstream, or the original G5, had gotten there, and they decided not to play. And they've been, as a consequence for that, playing catch up with that top end ever since, and lamenting the fact that indeed the top end outperformed everything else. And it was the most lucrative part of the market. And that's how they are a very, very, very distant third Matter of fact, last year, for the first time ever, they fell slightly below a double-digit market share in the entire market. So they basically had to do something. And oh boy, they went for the very top end, 7,500 nautical miles, massive fuselage, Pearl 10X engines. I mean, this thing is big. And it'll probably sell for exactly what the G700 and the Global 7500 sell for. So they're making a heck of a leap. It's an interesting example of leveraging defense revenue from strong Rafale fighter sales in this case. But I think this is an opportunity for many defense firms to basically increase their share of the commercial business because, well, they can do that kind of arbitrage. It's going to be really interesting to see whether they can kick their way into this, the rarefied air of the top end, because, you know, they've already sold about 500 G650s, 700s, probably more than that.
Right.
And they're, you know, sold out on the Global 7500 through 2023. You know, they might take advantage of product replacement cycles or I should say aircraft replacement cycles. But, you know, there's no question they're playing catch up here.
Ron, does the French company hack its way into the market as far as you're concerned, or is that going to be a lift too hard? Right. I mean, does their challenge become something that's not just on Mystique, but they're going to have to compete on price, performance, and technology with an all new airplane that they haven't built? Right. I mean, we saw the problems that Safran caused the company when it was trying to refresh the Falcon line. What's your sense on how this is likely to pay out, even if, you know, there's a lot of emotional goodwill going to the company? In terms of wishing it success,
Falcon makes a wonderful aircraft, right? I mean, I don't think that's, you know, debate. They have a very, very loyal following. You know, when I look at who's at most risk here, it's probably Bombardier. You know, Gulfstream has an extremely loyal following, and they have some, you know, fantastic products out there, a very, very strong brand. And you know, so you know, who has the most to lose here? Honestly, I think it's Bombardier with the 7500. You know, having a company come in with the pedigree of Dassault, with the following of Dassault, with the balance sheet of Dassault, it's going to be, I think, a bigger threat to Bombardier than it is to Gulfstream. And my guess is they can make a run at it, and they'll probably do pretty well, right? You know, provided that development goes well and all that. And, you know, ultimately, I mean, the issues they had was it the 5X, the 6X with the engine, that wasn't their fault, right? It was the engine supplier, right? So,
right.
You know, if everything kind of goes, you know, that, you know, properly in terms of with the supply chain and the subsystems, they should do just fine.
And those are things that Dassault tends to be pretty good at.
They make a good airplane. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who says they don't.
Sash, what did you
think? 2 points. I love Richard's historical perspective on this, and he's absolutely right. You know, they flunked one of the biggest structural product decisions that the business industry, the top end of the business industry, had ever seen 28 years ago. They're making up for it now. And you know, that of itself is fascinating. Second point that you know, Ron makes, and you know, particularly about engines, it's absolutely fascinating. It was SNECMA, Safran, that let them down big time on the Falcon 5X. The Falcon 5X failed totally as a program because SNECMA couldn't develop the Silvercrest engine. How astonishing that for this, the most important aircraft that I think Dassault's you know, committed to for at least 28 years, they go to Rolls-Royce. That really is telling you something about their relationship with Safran, or rather their lack of relationship with Safran, and their wish to get this right. Just looking at the specs, this isn't getting close to the Gulfstream 700 or indeed the Global 7500. It's bigger in every single dimension that matters. Maximum takeoff weight is nearly 4 tons, certainly 3.5 tons heavier than either of those machines. Cabin width over a foot wider. I love the way that they advertise you can fit a queen size bed in it. It's not a problem I've normally had, but it's very, very interesting indeed. And you know, the installed thrust is going to be at identical to the G700 because it's the same engines but with a slightly different name. I actually think Gulfstream's got more or as much to lose from this as Bombardier has, because the specifications are, they clearly looked at the G700 and realized they had to surpass it in every case, and in particular in terms of cabin width.
Go ahead, Ron.
So just one point that I would add, not necessarily disagreeing with Sash, but if you look at the when this aircraft's going to be in the market, when the 700 is going to be in the market, there is a lag between them, right? And if you look at how Gulfstream brings their aircraft to markets and then they do their updates, there'll be an update to the 700 probably within a year or two of when the 10X gets into the market, right? So I don't know. You know what I mean? We'll see.
Well, right. I mean, the adversary always gets a vote. When is this airplane going to enter service, Sash?
End of 2025. So basically, I've been in civil aerospace speak, that's early 26 or mid 26. Right.
And so that's roughly about the time, Ron, you're talking about. Yep. the Gulf, Gulfstream refreshing and going to a 750, for example, right? I mean,
the one weapon that Gulfstream really has that they've stuck to, and kudos to General Dynamics for this, allowing Gulfstream to do this. They spend a steady percentage of sales year in and year out on product development. They don't go on a product development vacation. It's a steady cadence on product development in Savannah at Gulfstream, and that has served them well, and I do believe it'll continue to serve them well.
Sash, don't have a lot of time left, but talk to us about Egypt's massive French order. France has been pretty much the Mediterranean power. I know that that'll make a lot of Italians bristle. I don't mean that offensively at all, but certainly projecting power at a time when tensions were running high between Turkey and Greece, exercising very closely, selling those two amphibious assault ships that were going to go to Russia, selling them to Egypt, sort of, deepening the relationship, having sold Rafales there before. Talk to us about this new order and the 330, and what does that combination mean?
Yeah, sure. Egypt was actually the first country, the first export customer for Rafale, which I think quite a lot of people forget. But it took quite a big plunge then. As it turned out, that was a very, very prescient move. They ordered 18 at the time. I apologize, 24 at the time. They've come back for another 30. And there's actually a rumor that they might replace all of their fleet of F-16 aircraft with Rafales, just to come down to a common fleet. It's a huge order, 3.75 billion euros, well over $4 billion. And why is this important? Well, firstly, the order includes at least two and up to six Airbus A330 tankers. So the A330 tanker is just becoming it's the tanker of choice in export markets. A six aircraft fleet is a big fleet for almost any country outside the UK and France. Secondly, this is important because deliveries for these aircraft take place probably 25, 26, 27, perhaps, 6 months lag from that, which is exactly when Dassault needs them to smooth the production line out in the mid-20s. I think Dassault is increasingly looking to me like a company that is thinking the next two decades. This decade, the 2020s, is about Rafale. Rafale, if they got an extension of order from India, they've now got this order from Egypt, they'll get some more orders from Greece. They would love to win Switzerland. That would be a fantastic order for them. Rafale will be producing at between two and three aircraft a month the whole of this decade, which is good because they're having to spend $2 billion on the Falcon 6X development, $2 billion and probably $3 billion on the Falcon 10X development. And those don't really start to produce decent profits until the tail end of the decade. But if you look in the 2030s, Rafale drops off. SCAF, FCAS, the Franco-German fighter, will be at a very early stage. Development work, very little margins. And I think that what they're doing with the Falcon 10X and the 6X is basically hoping that Falcon carries the burden in terms of profits and hence cash generation for the company in the early 30s, which is just when they need it. It's fascinating to see a company thinking one, two decades ahead rather than one or two quarters ahead.
Richard?
Yeah, I completely agree with Sash, of course, but what's also intriguing about it, what it means for the future of Dassault and the, of course, SCAF project, Egypt to be blunt, is perhaps not the ideal German arms market. You know, I mean, they generally like to keep track on how these things are used. And the Egyptians are all about power projection and, asserting a role in Libya and the Sudan and whatever else. That's not going to go over well with the Germans. And it's very clear that the idea of a Franco-German fighter is fundamentally flawed, especially if a green government comes in Germany. So I think in a lot of ways, leveraging what Sash is saying about Dassault looking for the future, I would be very surprised if when things get a bit tetchy again in Franco-German fighter negotiations, the Dassault folks don't use this as a way of saying, well, we can dominate this part of the market, the politically controversial part, people who want to buy a fighter who don't have to worry about asking to use the fighter before they use it. We're going to go it alone. Give us the money to come up with a next generation fighter plane after things don't go well with the Germans. And then the Germans leave and, of course, go join Tempest. You can pretty much see the future. And I think, you know, as Sash says, so can Dassault.
Can I just say, I love tetchy from Richard. That's terribly English. I'm very worried that you're being corrupted on this podcast, but you may be able to bear it.
go ahead, Ron. Did you have another point you wanted to make?
Huntington Ingalls and BWX Technologies also reported this week. So I kind of look at them as sort of the submarine complex, you know, XGD. And Huntington Ingalls actually reported an outstanding quarter. The Ingalls shipyard did quite well. And you know, they broadly beat expectations, and that was kind of reflected in their share price in the week. BWXT was largely in line with expectations. They gave a longer term outlook, which was also kind of in line with expectations as well.
Two last quick things. We've got about a minute left. Richard, talk to us. What did you think about the letter? 120 or so members of Congress supporting the F-35, right? A program that's been under a little bit of criticism. I guess it goes to the point all of you were making, right? It's the only game in town. How did you interpret that letter?
Yeah, I mean, exactly as you'd expect. There's such a huge industrial constituency behind the F-35, a lack of known options and perhaps a lack of options altogether for all we know. And, you know, it was always a bit of an overdone story, because if you look at the opposition from Congress, it was against plus-ups rather than the base budget. So, you know, we looked at our forecast and we didn't touch them. And I don't think anyone who forecasts fighter demand in the future really had an impact their numbers on the basis of congressional opposition. And don't forget, there's also a really big Marine caucus, and there may or may not be an F-35A alternative. There certainly isn't a B alternative. And if there isn't an F-35B in sufficient numbers, you've got about 10 amphibious assault carriers that, well, become helicopter carriers. That's not going to happen. So this plane, I think, remains sacrosanct for most of the decade, if not into the next decade.
And Sash, last point on the Challenger 3 tank. I know, you know, we mentioned it a little bit, and then important, obviously, from a Rheinmetall earnings standpoint. I mean, it's certainly important for a BAE when BAE reports as well. But talk to us a little bit about what is it with Brits and extremely spacious, gigantic tanks? Because I've been in a tank or two, and really the turret of a Chieftain or a Challenger is sort of more like a ballroom than a tank.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Brits, we've always, or not always, but of late, and I would define that as being about the last 75 years or so, have tried to go for, you know, maximizing armor, firepower, and, you know, fightability internally, generally, to our shame, at the expense of any sort of speed or indeed an ability to move. But, you know, you can get over that eventually. And Challenger and its forerunners, Chieftain, and then the revered Centurion are remarkably spacious tanks inside. As an anecdote for our listeners, a very, very good friend of mine who commanded Centurions, he used to be able to brief 22 members of his troop inside or leaning into through the various hatches, his commander's Centurions. These are very, very large things. Challenger 3 is a massive upgrade of the Challenger 2. I mean, you know, the Challenger name is there, but that's about it. And finally, and I feel rather sad about this, but we Brits are ditching the 120mm rifled gun and going for the gun that is the gun of the world, which is the Rheinmetall 120mm smoothbore. I have to say to the US, you now are operating an orphan fleet of L-44 120mm smoothbores. Everybody else is moving to the L-55 and the increased chamber pressure guns. Yours are going to be very, very underpowered compared to the stuff that's coming out of Germany at the moment. And that's going to be quite an interesting issue for an M1 upgrade 5-8 years out. As far as the Challenger 3 is concerned, we're not buying many of them. That's a shame. About, you know, 3-4 regiments worth. But it's going to
How many tanks?
It's 148 tanks at the moment. But my God, these are going to be, I mean, that the upgrade is about 5 million sterling each. So, and that gets you gun, fire control system, sensors, complete digital turret, and so forth. It's money well spent. It keeps us in, the Brits in the heavy armor market, which I think is a very, very good thing. And clearly, this is very good news for Antal.
I should give a shout out. Challenger 2 did perform with distinction everywhere that it's been deployed. So just wanted to give a shout out there to the Royal Tank Corps and the tremendous work that they do on behalf of everybody on the planet. So
and I should just add that if you ever want a cup of tea when you are operating the Challenger 2 tanks and 3 tanks, you go to the back of the tank, you pick up the telephone, you book your tea, and it will be boiled for you in the boiling vessel in the turret and then delivered to you some way or somehow, even if under fire. It's a great service.
At first, Americans were stunned with that entire concept until they used it and they were like, wow, what a great idea. So anyway, guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great week. And please wish Lucy, Kate, and Casey a very, very good Mother's Day. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bargo. Great to be here.
Thanks so much, Bargo.
Thanks, Bargo. And of course, happy Mother's Day to Chris there.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.